Happy Monday, everyone. Doug here, really excited for this week's bonus interview. It is so rad. I had somebody reach out to me and they're like, hey, you want to interview a rock star? And it was pretty awesome. His name's Jeffrey Bryan. He's a musician, a songwriter, composer, plays keyboard, guitar, vocals, and he's currently in the band Survivor, who has hits like Eye of the Tiger, Burning Heart, and the title track from Karate Kid Part 1. And he was actually in the movie. So before we get in that, I gotta play the new bonus theme by my buddy TJ. Hit that theme.
When you're looking for more and there's no place to go, it's a sequels only bonus show. It's not about sequels this time, you know, it's a sequels only bonus show. Doug and his pals, well, they know what to do. Talking about movies without a part two. Looking for more and there's no place to go. It's a sequels only bonus show. Talking to stars with Doug Ditsold. It's a sequels only bonus show. Sequels only bonus show.
Hey there. So I alluded to it just before. This is the first rock star that I've interviewed. I know Bill Sadler. He plays banjo, and a few of the people I interviewed, they do play instruments. And but man, this guy is a true rock and roller. Grew up in LA. He talked about playing all the amazing places, the Viper Room, Whiskey Go-Go, like all those names that you know. And man, dude, so cool that I was able to talk to him. And he does a lot of jingles for a lot of TV shows. He composes for movies and TV shows too, and series. He does it all, and he was really cool. He looked like a rock star, and you'll see it if you're watching on the video, and you'll see that, which is pretty rad. So without further ado, here is my first rock star, Jeffrey Bryan. This is awesome, dude.
Nice to meet you, man.
Nice to meet you. That's cool. That's so cool that April reached out. And dude, some of the cool stuff that you worked on, uh-huh, it's pretty rad.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. Grew up in the 80s.
And you grew up in LA, right?
Oh, yeah. Born and raised.
That's so cool. I was just talking to an LA guy. Do you ever see Monster Squad?
The Monster Squad? No.
Yeah. It was like it came out in 87. It was about like these four kids going against like all the old school Universal monsters, like the Wolfman and Dracula.
I think it's an LA kid. It vaguely rings a bell. Yeah. It was like a low budget type of.
Yeah. But yeah, so I was just talking to him. He was an LA guy. And it's like a different, I've talked to so many different folks, like actors. You're the first like pretty much full musician. I've interviewed actors and stuff that are musicians too.
Yeah. I looked at your roster and it looks like it's quite a bit of actors. So
it is. Well, some people that play instruments like William Sadler, he plays a little bit of banjo. Like that's
cool.
Yeah, dude.
Like the Steve Martin thing.
Yes. Yeah. So how did it all start for you? Like growing up in LA, is it just something you're thrown into?
Well, I was singing from a pretty young age. About 10, 11, 12 years old, I discovered that I had a voice, you know, a big voice in this little package of this big voice, and I got a lot of attention from it. So it was, let me take one of these off. That's better. Okay. I got these in-ears on.
Oh, nice.
Sometimes they don't always sound great when they're both in there. So I was singing in LA, just doing, you know, being a kid and learning how to sing and enjoying, my parents' records and just kind of discovering music. And that's how it kind of all started for me. I didn't like wake up one day and said, I want to be like, you know, Paul McCartney or Elton John or something like that. It just it gradually built into a life that I grew into as a really young, you know, just discovering talents that I may have had at that age. It was pretty organic, you know.
What were some of the records that you remember? What was like some of the early ones that you sang?
Oh my God. Everything from Crime of the Century, Supertramp,
nice.
The Knack. It goes all over the place. Hotel California, Kansas. I mean, I was singing Carry On My Wayward Son at 11 years old with the guitar, you know, banging that out. Anything that had a really good vocal, I enjoyed. I mean, that was my thing. It was just, I wanted to sing. I didn't know what it meant. I didn't know how that was going to, you know, turn into a music for me. I just knew that this was fun. I liked the attention I was getting. And then I realized very, very quickly, pretty young, that if I was going to do this, I got to stop singing other people's songs, or at least learn how to sing some of my own, because maybe I have something I should be doing. So that's when the instrument started to come into play. A lot of musicians, it's the other way around. They get taught to play piano at like some ridiculous old age. You know, that's how they start. But for me, it was the opposite. I just wanted to be able to accompany myself and write songs. And so I naturally had to learn how to play an instrument in my mind to do that. So that's how that all came about.
What was the first instrument that you started playing?
It was guitar. Actually, that's not true. I had drum lessons when I was really young, probably 6-7 years old. And I was probably too young to have them. I didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I was always pretty musical. What's interesting is my family's not particularly musical. they don't play instruments, or it wasn't that I had an older brother or younger brother or whatever that I could learn from. It was just me. I just discovered something I really, that spoke to me, I guess, you know? And so guitar was my first instrument, and it was the obvious choice, considering it's lightweight and relatively easy to bang out a few chords and figure out what I'm doing. But I was taking years of, by that time I was junior high and early high school, I was taking years of theory classes and counterpoint and all kinds of different classical training musically, but not with an instrument, just music. So I could read and write music. I just never applied it to an instrument.
Wow.
So by the time I was playing guitar, I knew what I was playing musically. But for some reason, the guitar really didn't kind of resonate with me. And there was a piano in the house, and that piano was always supposed to be for my sister. Don't touch the piano. That's her thing. And I'm like, she's not touching the piano. So, I finally gave up about 15 years old. I just kept looking at the piano. I had a lot of information. I understood music by that time. I mean, I could, you know, look at a piece of music, tell you what's going on with it. I couldn't play it because I didn't know an instrument, you know. I learned it from a singing point of view, but I understood four-part harmonies. I understood chorales and, you know, minuets and things like that. Things that a piano player would normally have learned by now, I learned them sort of virtually.
Yeah.
Without the aid of an instrument. And so I just decided to sit down at the piano, and it was love at first sight. When it finally sat down, I was like, oh my God, this is the missing link for me. You know, this is it. So that's where everything started to explode. It was like, once I finally figured out I could play the piano, everything musically just kind of took me on a trajectory that I hadn't been able to understand prior to that, you know, kind of opened up my world.
So wasn't it at 15 you played on the Merv Griffin show?
Yeah, actually it was a little bit, I think I was 16 or 17 by then.
Yeah.
82. Yeah, I guess I was 16, yeah.
But how does that happen from that moment when you first sit down at a piano, say a year and a half, 2 years later, how does that, that's pretty...
It's pretty crazy. I know there were some events during those early years that when I look back, I mean, I don't know how I didn't get whiplash. It was amazing. I mean, holy crap. What happened was like I said, I had this passion to sing and get in front of people. And it's interesting because at that age, I didn't even know why, you know. I can totally explain it now. I know why I'm doing what I'm doing. But at that age, I had this drive. And so I was, I played every club you could think of that would let me in. you know, my parents would bring me in, have me go on stage, and then hustle me out the door because, you know, it's a bar. So I would do these open mic nights. And I did a couple. There was one called The Hungry Tiger. I don't know. Where are you from, by the way?
I'm in Jersey. But I interview a lot of people in LA, and I work with an actor helping him put his memoirs together. And
yeah.
A lot of the places you had on there, he like told me he used to do like open mic or go there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like that. So yeah.
Yeah. There was a restaurant chain called The Hungry Tiger. I haven't said those words in a long time. and that was a place where you, unlike today, everything's open mic. You got YouTube, yeah. You've got down the street, you got coffee bars. Then it was kind of a new thing where you could get up and just sing. So I would go and sign up and have my dad bring me or whatever, and I would do my two songs, and I'd go home. There was a gentleman there, Mark Lemkin was his name. He ended up being I found out, he was the road manager for Seals and Crofts.
Oh, wow.
And he produced a variety show at the Roxy and another one at the Laugh Stop. So two clubs.
Yeah.
And it was a children's show that was every Sunday. These parents could sign their kids up and they'd file in and have these big birthday parties. I guess the Roxy and needed money. I don't know what the deal was, but it was the best thing that ever happened to me because got this gig. It didn't pay. It wasn't, you're going to get paid. You're going to get promotion. And boy, he was right. I mean, you know, I didn't care. I was just an opportunity to get up in front of an audience every week. I was like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of people that were, a lot of actors, a lot of stage moms and their kids. I was one of the older ones, and I ended up writing music for some of these kids. And,
oh, wow.
I mean, I was older. I was, 17, 16 years old?
Yeah.
And I considered myself to be old. So that tells you the kind of how young some of these kids were.
Yeah.
And, but it was an opportunity to perform every week. And I guess it got a little bit of notoriety in the local news. And one of the casting agents for a national talk show, Merv Griffin, came down to check it out. And they wanted to do a segment on the Merv Griffin show of these kids that are performing like professionals every week at these well-known places. And so I got asked if I wanted to appear on the show to sing a song. As if I had an album out or something, you know? I mean, I hadn't done anything. But I had songs. And I begged these people, let me do my songs. They wouldn't let me sing my own song. I had to pick a song from a list of pre-licensed crap that they insisted. But it was cool. I managed to find songs I liked. So I ended up, you know, picking something decent, I guess. That was how that happened. It was just performing and being seen and then asked to, they were just, it was, you know, just sort of the sign of the times. It was kind of a new thing and it was kind of newsworthy, I guess. And so they did this segment and it was popular at the time.
That's awesome. No, it's so cool. The fact that at that young of an age, you're on the piano, you're on that. So from there, how did, I know you're in LA, so it's pretty much LA. You're going to act somehow. How did that go from, how did you even get into acting? Did somebody approach you or?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, it all came from the Merv Griffin.
Wow.
Because I mean, you picked the right, there's so many events, so many strange events in my life. I'm sure a lot of people's lives are like that. But in my case, that particular event hinged on a lot of doors that sort of swung open unexpectedly. I wasn't really ready to play piano in front of people. I was a singer. I was really strong at being a front man and a singer. So it wasn't so much the keyboards was a thing yet. It was just something I was doing. When I did the Merv Griffin show, I got back to the green room and, there was I remember there was a card and some flowers or something. And it was some manager. that apparently had managed some of these other kids. I mean, there were people in the show that went on, you know, like a guy named Mark Price, who used to be on the Michael J. Fox series. He was, what was his name in the show? He was
he his buddy?
Yeah.
Well, oh, was, yeah, yeah,
can't,
yeah.
Can't remember his name for some reason. I used to be friends with him years and years ago. Yeah. Robbie Rist from Brady Bunch was in this. Yeah. You know, there were a ton of like semi kind of known young actors that weren't really known, but
yeah.
Some of them went on to do some great things. Some of them you never heard from them again. And this particular manager guy was kind of involved in that. I guess they saw something marketable with me. I mean, I was what, 16, 17 years old, roughly in that neighborhood. And I could still play 12 or 13. You know, yeah. I look really young. I actually had hair. So, you know,
you did. Yeah.
So, I didn't look like this, but anyway, so I think that's what kind of got them interested. The singing, obviously they thought I was talented, but this guy wanted to push me into commercials and things. And I'm like, why? Well, that's not what I do. And, you know, I got a lot of advice from people that are like, no, this is an opportunity. You take what you can get, you know, it's Hollywood, just go with it. And I was young and impressionable. And I said, all right, whatever. I wasn't really that interested in acting. It never was something that I've never really done anything in my life that was something, if I wasn't passionate about it or resonate with me in some way, I didn't pursue it. It just, yeah. You know, I'm not that kind of a person that would just do something because it had a dollar sign attached to it or some other more superficial reason. And even at 16 years old, I kind of sensed that this felt phony to me, even though that was kind of immature, maybe a little naive because maybe I closed doors and didn't mean to, you know. So that's how that happened. He got me an agent, and they were sending me on commercials, and I never got a single commercial because I was a horrible actor. Actually, it wasn't so much I was a horrible actor. It's just commercials. I wanted to be a rock star.
Yeah.
And I don't understand how biting into this cheeseburger is going to make me a rock star. You know, that was my attitude at 15 years old, you know? So
you're like singing while you're eating the burger, and the director's like, kid, just say the line.
That's exactly. I went into a couple interviews and I'm looking at these lines, and I didn't know how to emotionalize. Is that a word? Emotionalize. I didn't know how to turn them into something. I knew how I could sing it. And a couple times I said, let me just sing this. Cause you know, that's what I felt like I could do well.
Yeah.
And so I felt like I was being kind of pushed in a direction I wasn't sure was right for me. Who knows? But I pushed my agency, the agency that I was with, which was a commercial agency. They had a small division for a theatrical division. And I begged them to send me out on, you know, like actual parts. And I don't know what I was thinking. I had no acting history. I had years of music training by this time, but I didn't know a thing about how to pick up a script and memorize it and, you know, do what actors do. And I felt a little bit like a fish out of water, but they sent me on a couple interviews and I was getting them. So it was a different time period though. You got to remember it was the 80s. And in those days, similar to like horror films kind of were cheap and easy to make, are cheap and easy to make nowadays. Yeah. So to speak. Well, back then it was the coming of age films for, you know, like Porky's and Fast Times at Ridgemont High and Breakfast Club and all that stuff. And so, I went out on all that stuff, by the way.
Yeah.
I would meet a lot of these people that became sort of the Rat Pack people before anyone knew who they were. 10 Soldiers. Well, actually, what's the name of that movie? The Red Dawn. It was called.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It was called 10 Soldiers when I.
It was.
Yeah, that was the working title, and I went out for that, and there was everybody. I mean, there was everyone from Swayze to C. Thomas Howell. I mean, they were all there. I don't know any of them. I wasn't a pop culture guy. I didn't follow things like that. I was a musician. You know, I, I just felt kind of like, I don't know, in a different space. But all those people were there. I did a scene with C. Thomas Howe. He got it. I didn't. It was John Milius, I think, was the director. And anyway, it became Red Dawn. But
yeah,
I have a ton of those stories. I went on all that stuff. Didn't get most of them, obviously. But I got a couple, you know, obviously Karate Kid, which led me there, which was interesting because Karate Kid was not the first movie I was in, although it came out before the first movie I was in. So chronologically, it came later. First movie I was in was called Hot Moves.
Yeah, which is like Porky's.
Yeah, yeah. It's like if Porky's had a like a really shitty brother, it would be Hot Moves. It was, I don't know. I think they made it for 20 cents. It was one of those, I got to work.
Yeah.
I got in front of a camera. I'll never forget those first scenes. You know, I just showed up on set and, all right, go. You know, there was no director practically. I mean, it was like, I don't know who was making this movie, but that was a lot of fun.
That's awesome.
It was
kind of cool that you had that experience, that it was kind of like you were doing whatever you want. Because if you had like a Stalin director, it could have been like the worst experience ever. So maybe it was good that they were super lax.
I think yes and no. I think I wanted direction.
Oh,
you know?
Okay.
I was scared, you know. I mean, I didn't show it, but I was like, wow, here I am. I have no idea what I'm doing, and I have nobody to help me. And it wasn't like I was, you know, crying myself to sleep over it. It just felt awkward, you know. I think if I had a little bit more training, I guess, or some preparation, I may have had something to fall back on and felt a little more secure. The truth of the matter is that it didn't matter. It wasn't like this was Shakespeare.
Yeah.
You know, it just go in there and be a kid. That's what you are. And you'll probably be fine. But as a kid who had these visions of being, you know, Dennis DeYoung, you know, or whatever, I kept having these confusing thoughts about what the hell am I doing here, you know? But it led me to a lot of very cool people, a lot of cool places, and I certainly don't regret it.
Oh yeah, I think the coolest thing is, and we'll talk about it all, but is the whole Karate Kid connection to like what you're
doing now?
Yeah, dude.
Yeah, I know. No one would believe that.
It's unreal. They
even are like, what?
Yeah.
I'm not sure they care as much as I do, but I find that really fascinating. I sometimes have to stop and think, you know, there's something going on here. What's interesting about Survivor, you're talking about Survivor for the people.
Yeah.
I don't know. The thing about Survivor, a lot of people don't know this, or maybe some do. You know, some fans probably definitely know that, you know, the fact that they were involved in the Rocky series is not surprising that they were involved in the Karate Kid. Yeah. Rocky III. There you go. Now that's Rocky IV. That's
Rocky
Burning
IV,
Heart.
Yeah. Burning Heart.
Burning Heart. Yeah. I'm thinking Eye of the Tiger is Rocky III.
Record. That was a steal at a thrift store.
Really?
Fuck. Yeah.
Yeah. I know. Isn't that a shame? I walk into these vinyl stores and I'm picking up all these great records for $1 or $2. But a lot of people didn't know that John Avildsen was the director of Karate Kid. And John Avildsen was also the original director of Rocky I. So there was a connection. Plus, Jerry Weintraub, who produced these movies, produced the Rocky series and produced the Karate Kid series. So he was trying to create a similar – he had so much success with Rocky, he wanted to create it with the Karate Kid. Bill Conti, who did the score for Karate Kid, same guy that wrote, you know, Gonna Fly Now.
Yeah.
Da-da-da-da-da-da. He wrote all that. They used a lot. So when Survivor had such a big success with Eye of the Tiger, they were – and this is why it gets weird, because a lot of people will dig this – they were kind of forced to do the moment of truth. They their record company, Scotti Brothers, I think it was at the time, was kind of said, no, we're going to get you Survivor to do the theme song of Karate Kid. And when they got to the studio, they said, here's the song you'll be doing.
Oh.
They didn't write that song. And they were like, what? Are you kidding me? But what's interesting about the moment of truth is that I don't know how much you know about Survivor, but their first singer, Dave Bickler, who sang Eye of the Tiger, by the time they got to Karate Kid, the moment of truth, Dave was having throat problems and they got a new singer, Jimmy Jameson. Jimmy is famous for singing, you know, all the big hits off Vital Signs and beyond.
Yeah.
The Search Is Over and High on You and Can't Hold Back. That's all Jimmy. So all the big hits that came after the Eye of Tiger was a different singer, but I wouldn't say his audition, but his first throw into Survivor was the moment of truth.
Oh my God.
They stuck him in there and said, well, here, sing this. We didn't write it. We have to do it. Hold on a second.
Oh, no problem, dude.
I just pulled my, sorry about that. Pulled my headphones up. So what's interesting is that the first song he sang on that was recorded and released was not a Survivor song. It's kind of interesting. I'll give you a little side note about that. The song was written by Bill Conti, who is, you know, the same guy that wrote all that stuff for Rocky, and Peter Beckett from Player.
Oh, wow.
Baby Come Back. The guy that wrote Baby Come Back. So those two guys must have got together and wrote a song and convinced whoever was in charge of the music supervising to get Survivor to play their song. When I finally started working with Survivor, I said, hey, when are we going to do Moment of Truth? What a cool thing. I was in that movie. They're like, don't bring it up again. We don't do that song. I'm like, but fans will love it. And we don't care. We don't do it. It's not ours. I'm like, okay.
And I think, correct me,
don't bring it up again.
I think you're in the music video.
I am, yeah. Of the trailer. Yeah, I'm in the trailer of the movie.
Well, yeah. No, I think you're in the music video.
I'm sorry. They used a piece of the trailer in their video for Moment of Truth. That's right. Yeah. And yeah, I'm in it. Yeah. I mean, it's you know.
Yeah, but still, it's pretty cool. But,
I mean, it's amazing, right? I mean, I didn't know these guys. 30 years later, I'm playing keyboards for them. And it's funny, though, because there's been other little near misses I had with them that I didn't know until I look back.
Oh, really?
When they were recording at Rumbo Recorders, which is in used to be in Granada Hill. West Hills. And there used to be a recording studio there called Rumbo. And a lot of people it wasn't like on the radar for a lot of musicians, just certain ones, because it was way out of the way. It's in the valley. No one wanted to go to the valley. So they always had these, you know, I mean, David Bowie recorded there.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, Tom Petty, everybody did. But the guy that owned the recording studio was Daryl Dragon, Captain of Tennille.
Oh, wow.
And he owned the recording studio. And I knew Daryl because of a band I was in with a friend of mine. His name is Patrick Boland. He used to be in Pure Prairie League. And we had an original band. And he knew Daryl. And Daryl led us into the studio to record our demos for my original band in the 80s. And it was just around the same time that they were recording, I think it was Premonition, one of the Survivor records.
Yeah, wow.
And I didn't meet them, but who knows how many times I may have walked through the same door that they did just within days or hours. You know, it was during that time period because we talked about it. And so I kind of put the dates together. So there's been a lot of like little weird things that, and the other thing is Daryl Dragon played on the album for Survivor.
Oh, really?
He played a lot of the keyboard parts. So there was just the weird connections, you know, that you wouldn't think that they would be until you look back and put them together and get, you know, I think I find that more fascinating than they do.
Yeah, maybe.
But
no, but that's awesome, dude.
Yeah.
So we'll talk more about the music, but for Karate Kid itself, How long were you on set for that movie?
Actually, quite a long time.
Really?
Almost the whole movie, yeah. Originally, I went in, it was a two-week deal. It was supposed to be a walk-in, walk-out. You're going to meet the director, John, and that was it. I met him. We did a little video thing. He talked to me on video. I didn't read any lines, and I got a call from my agent, said, you just booked 2 weeks on this movie that they're doing, Columbia Pictures. I went, oh, okay, great. And before I even got to set, days before that, it was changed. They extended all of our contracts for, I worked on it from the almost 6 months.
Wow. Yeah,
four to 6 months.
Oh my God.
It was originally, there was Frankie Avalon Jr., Tom Fridley, who I think his uncle is John Travolta. There was Ken Daly and Israel Warby. Those guys were my friends. We were like a little pack. Nice. And they had us sort of developing our little thing. And then you had the Cobra Kai guys, Billy Zabka and all, there you go. And all the rest of them. And we didn't interact on purpose.
Oh, really? That's
they
cool.
They kept a very adversarial atmosphere on the set. So coming from Hot Moves, which I did earlier that summer, which no direction, to really being the lowest man on the totem pole. I mean, they could have asked me to sweep the floor, and I thought, and I, not with my leg. I mean, literally with a broom, and I thought that was probably going to be my job because, I was so low on the totem pole. And it was, it was, for me, it was a very big production. It was Columbia Pictures.
Oh yeah.
Jerry Weintraub. You had all these, relatively well-known names. Not all of us were well-known, but the people they were connected to were all connected in the industry. Chad McQueen. That's right. He was there. I know. And let me tell you, that guy is an animal.
He looks intense in the movie.
That's him.
Yeah.
He would throw these parties. Oh my God. I don't know how anyone survived. yeah, he was crazy. There were always something going on. The one person that we never saw, and we all kind of came together on this, was Ralph. Oh. Ralph was sequestered in a Winnebago for the entire time until it was time for him to come out. And there was a reason for that. I learned later on that John Avildsen, he wanted an atmosphere that he didn't feel safe. He wanted it to make it so when he got in front of Billy, Zabka's character, he didn't want to feel like he had a camaraderie with them at all off stage.
Oh, wow.
And so it was almost he had a method approach to how he wanted the actors to be. And as a young, fairly inexperienced guy and being kind of small, and not knowing any karate or not knowing really anything, I felt very threatened on that. I felt like it was high school, man. I was like, I'm back in freaking high school. This is horrible. Get me off this job. And I kept bugging my agent. When's this going to end? This is horrible. But it wasn't horrible. It's just that was the job. It was a lot of. Anyway, I'm sorry. I'm rambling here.
Oh no, dude, I love it. No, because you know what? I would never have known the formula. Hollywood does it all the time. And in the music industry, they do that. There's a formula. Oh my God, this works. So let's do Rocky,
right?
With a 16-year-old kid from Jersey.
Exactly.
And it's crazy the way he sequestered him so he would feel that way, and the way they split you guys upset, so it's like the animosity can like spill over.
Yeah, they wanted That's it awesome. Brewing. They wanted it to brew. I remember when we got to the final fight scenes, the tournament, which was filmed at Cal State Northridge.
Oh, really?
It was before, in 1994, there was a huge earthquake out here.
Yeah.
You probably remember the 94 earthquake, the Northridge earthquake. It destroyed that building that we filmed in. It was the auditorium. And so it's not there anymore, but that's where it was filmed. And by the time we got to that point in the filming, you know, the schedule, you really thought people were going to break some heads. I mean, you know, people were mad at people. It was like, there was, you know, it was looking back, it was probably an understandable thing. You know, people that were more experienced probably understood what was going on, but I was like, holy shit, I'm talking to these guys. Everyone seemed angry, you know?
Yeah.
But that was part of the atmosphere that he wanted to create. And he did a brilliant job of it.
Oh yeah.
You know, I'm telling you, there was fear in Ralph's eyes when that was real.
I don't know if they did that for the other movies, but I interviewed the guy. I don't know if you ever saw the third one, but Sean Kanan. Sean Kanan, who played Mike Barnes, Karate's bad boy.
Right.
And in that movie, that's one thing, because what we do is our formula, for the most part, like I'll interview, like you're so rad. And like if anybody that talks to me isn't in a movie sequel, I still get it out. Like, but my formula is I interview folks that worked on movie sequels to get like behind the scenes kind of stuff. And then me and my buddy review it. Sometimes we have like a guest on. So when we watch that movie, because you watch a movie different when you're like taking notes and like,
yeah, of course,
almost dissecting it.
Yeah.
So when we watch the third one, and when I talk to Sean, I even said, I'm like, this whole movie, you know, Ralph Macchio looks like scared. And then the third one, if you remember, it's really like three adults trying to kick the shit out of a 19-year-old kid. You have Martin Cove, who's an alcoholic nut job.
Yeah.
Mike Barnes. And then, dude, I don't know what he was in after it. I don't think he was in much. So I tried to interview him. But the guy who played Terry Silver, dude, his character in that movie, if you haven't seen it in a while, it's like so worth it to go back. He's like this really rich guy with like 10 cars, huge house.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah. Dude, and he'll do anything to help out his buddy Martin Cove.
Yeah. Yeah, they're insane. It's an insane character. But you're right. I think you'll understand this. There was an innocence to the first Karate Kid.
Oh, yeah.
That you're not going to get on those others.
I know.
In my opinion, I mean, the Cobra Kai series is special for other reasons.
Yeah.
And it makes sense because it's not trying to duplicate Karate Kid directly. Yeah. You know, it's sort of a generational kind of view of it. Whereas the other Karate Kids, they were trying to plug in this same formula into the original film that the original film was successful with and just kind of stamp them, you know?
Yeah.
And I think there was a little bit of authenticity that we lost in 2 and 3, in my opinion.
Well, that happens with most. It's really hard. Every sequel that we've covered, it's really hard. It's very rare that sequel is better than the original. It's like a very rare occurrence, but it's just cool what direction they take sequels. Like we covered Jaws 2. I directed one of the guys that helped build the shark. That movie, the shark becomes like almost we said he was like Jason Voorhees, because in the movie you see the shark's POV like hunting people, and it's like sharks don't do that. He didn't do it in the first one, but
I guess they have to, you know, they get a little carried away sometimes.
Oh, right. Yeah.
You know, but what I was saying about the original Karate Kid is that there was definitely an air of fear on the set. And that was absolutely created by the director.
That's awesome.
You know?
So some of the cool things I saw on your little bio on your website, which was so awesome.
Thank you.
Was the composing. See, like when I interview people, if you didn't have a bio and just say you're like an IMDb or some other website, sometimes people don't have everything. So during the conversation, they'll be like, oh, I used to do blank. And it's like, what? But the fact that it's cool that you did all the composing on like those movies, like Carnal Crimes, Reunion, and all the game shows and like, how did that come about? How'd you get approached for that?
Well, you're talking about 30 years of writing music.
So you did it that long?
No, I've been doing
it. Oh, okay.
You know, some of that work is not that long ago, and some of it is a long time ago.
Oh, cool.
When I was, after Karate Kid, I have to go back to the 80s to explain that,
Oh, yeah,
explain
yeah.
the answer. Karate Kid was a very, very difficult movie for me, even though I ended up having almost no lines.
Yeah.
I mean, it was difficult for that reason. I went to my dressing room every day and there were redacted lines. And honestly, they just didn't need all of us. They had, you know, four or five of us in a camp that they never explored. And, you know, the movie would have been too long and unnecessary. So yeah. I get it. They had to make executive decisions, and certain people, I was being paid though to wait to see if I was going to work. And I know it sounds funny, but that's how the business can be sometimes. I was not able to go on interviews. I mean, even if I did, I wouldn't be able to take the jobs. I was contracted to Columbia Pictures during that time period. So I mean, it wasn't that they weren't paying me well. It was great. It just was not what an 18-year-old wanted for him, you know, for myself. I wanted to be moving forward, and I felt like I was not. So Karate Kid was difficult. And when it was over, when I finally got let out of my contract, it was a year of acting. I did a few other walk-ons on some TV shows that aren't in the bio. Not that you mentioned that. I did a few things, and the whole year was just really cool. But by the time The Karate Kid ended, it was December, I think, of 83.
Wow.
And I looked around. I was technically out of work, obviously, and unemployed. And I was thinking, well, now what, you know? So I pushed my agent to get me, whatever I could get. And at this point I was thinking pilot season and, when I did working with Hot Moves, I knew like a lot of people from, Michael J. Fox and all those guys. I used to hang out with those guys because the people I worked with on Hot Moves were in High School USA, which one of his first movies. And so, I knew Todd Bridges. I knew all those people just from hanging out. They were in my acting classes and I knew them. I thought, I'll keep doing this. I'll get a sitcom, or I'll get something and I'll be able to pay the bills. That'd be great. I wasn't getting any work. And I thought to myself, well, if I'm going to be broke, I might as well be broke doing what I love to do, because I'm not even sure I can do this, because I haven't really gotten a part that can test me yet, you know? So I looked around. I said, well, let's see. When was the last time I performed? When was the last time I put a guitar in my hands? And I think I was 19. And I said, you know what? I'm going to start a band and get going. And so I put all my energy into music. And during that time period, I started bands, and a few years into doing my own bands, I got a publishing deal with A&M. It was Almo Irving, which was the publishing company for A&M Records, which was later purchased by Rondor. So now it's Rondor. But at the time, PolyGram purchased their publishing. So I ended up losing the publishing deal, but that's another story. But so I had a publishing deal, and I was a staff writer at A&M for a very short period of time. And it taught me that there's ways to make money, other than just getting up on stage. And that's when I started pursuing films and TV work. And again, remember we were talking about connections?
Yeah.
That first connection that got me the Roxy shows, that got me on the Merv Griffin show. Well, that guy, who was the road manager for Seals and Crofts, he knew a lot of people in the business. So I would talk to him, and we did, he was producing something called Swayze Dancing, which was back in those days, you didn't have Netflix, you didn't have streaming, you had the home video market.
Yes.
Remember that? And so you could go to like a Blockbuster. God, I sound old. Or, or a Warehouse Records or something, and you could rent a video. And not all the videos were made by studios. They were individuals or small production companies. Yeah. Anyway, he was producing not Patrick Swayze, But get this, Patrick Swayze's mom, who taught Patrick Swayze how to dance,
what,
wanted to capitalize on Swayze on Dirty Dancing.
Oh my
so
god, dude!
Somehow he convinced her, not this guy Mark Lemkin, convinced Patrick's mother, who was an older lady at this point. She was probably in her 60s, a really strong Texas drawl. I mean, she was the antithesis of a seasoned looking type of someone you'd put in a movie. She was very raw and rough, and it was a very low budget thing. Anyway, he asked if I wanted to write music to it. So that's how I started that. And
oh my God. What kind of music did you write? Like dance kind of too?
Yeah. Just, they didn't have a budget to license anything. So they needed some schmuck that they could pay almost nothing for that would, you know, knock off some songs, you know, or make it sound like, Tiffany or something.
Oh, you that's know? What you do? You just like hear
at that
a song
time,
and like,
well, no, you would get the way a lot of that works is it works the same way now is it's called temp tracks. So when they're editing a track, they'll put a song in that they can't either afford or it's not available to license. Same thing happened with The Eye of the Tiger, you know, with Another One Bites Dust.
Oh,
that was,
yeah.
That was the temp track and they didn't get the licensing for it. Well, that happens all the way down the line. Doesn't matter the size of the production. And so they had, you know, they would say, well, we need a piece that sounds like X, or we needed a piece that sounds like this person. And so you would write something inspired by those references so they would match the edits. That's just typical. That's pretty normal.
Yeah. That's pretty cool.
That's how I got into realizing I could do more music. So that led me to a lot of home video productions, because the company that was putting it together, I walked in there and said, hey, I'm doing the music for your production here. What else you got? You know? And they said, well, we don't have much budget. I said, I'm broke. I'll just give me anything. And so they just laid it out. I said, well, we got this movie coming up next month. We got this one. God, if I go back and think, it was the time when, you know, the Jane Fonda workout videos were popular.
Yeah.
There was, what was his name? Dirk Benedict, or there was an actor that was on the A-Team, Dirk something.
Oh, I can't think of his last name, but I knew you're talking about.
There were four guys of the A-Team. Mr. T and what's his name?
I'm guessing it'd be Face was that guy, right?
Yes. Yeah. 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 Anyway, he had a workout video. I did the music to that. I never met these people. I just was handed the video and say, write music. I did a bunch of beauty pageants, you know, that Vegas beauty pageants that some companies were putting. Just whatever, you know, whatever. It didn't matter. I was a paycheck and I could, it was real music and that's all I cared about. So that's what I was doing that concurrently while I was playing in bands in LA. Yeah. So I was doing both. And guess what? It's never stopped. I'm doing the same thing I did, except with the exception of, you know, traveling with a national act.
Yeah.
that's a little bit different. But other than that, I'm still in bands right now. I'm still performing everywhere I can, and I'm still trying to write music for productions.
That's awesome, man.
My life hasn't changed a lot. You know?
What were some of the, because you were in a bunch of bands, what were some of the, and you started a lot of the bands, right?
Yeah, they were my creations. Yeah. Cool.
What were some of the singer. What were some of the best names?
I wouldn't call them great names.
Your babies.
Yeah, well, wait, you mean songs or band?
No, about like the name of the bands.
Oh, The Reach was one of them. That was back when we were influenced by The Fix. Oh, okay. The Reach. But actually, that was a cool band. Like I said, a gentleman named Patrick Bolin, who these guys were all older than me. I was like 21 and they were in their 30s. So I thought they were like, oh my God, these guys are old, but this will be all right. But they had huge resumes. Patrick worked with Kenny Rogers and he was in Pure Prairie League for a while and, did a lot of, you know, a lot of national, played guitar for a lot of national guys. And then I can't remember the drummer's name, but he toured with the Beach Boys for some period of time. Oh, wow. So we had some like really talented guys.
Yeah.
In the band, and that band didn't make it. And then actually what happened was I was in the band. It was doing fine. We recorded with Daryl Dragon at his studio, all that stuff. And A&M Records saw me at Michelli's. It was my birthday. And I was asked to get up and sing a song. So I got up and I sat down at the piano and I played a ballad. And I went back, and everybody claps, but I went back and sat down with my friends back, and embarrassingly. And somebody, I swear it's a Hollywood moment. Someone walks up to my table, plops a card down on the table. And I look at it and says, A&M Records. And they said, give us a call. I'm like, okay. I was, really? All right. So that's how that happened. And I called them, and it was a publishing deal. They wanted to offer me a publishing deal. That's how that thing came about.
Yeah.
And it was because of that publishing deal that the band broke up. They didn't want the band. They wanted the guy that was singing and writing the songs.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, that's just the way, you know, it went. So that kind of, we went our separate ways. When PolyGram purchased Almore Irving, it destroyed my world, because everybody on the roster that wasn't a hit songwriter or a hit songwriter yet was being let go. They were just, you know, they were letting everyone loose. They were just cutting people loose left and right. And I was one of the casualties of that. I didn't have a track record yet. I wasn't there long enough to get that. So I was floundering, and I went on my merry way and decided to put together another band. And that was the Jeffrey Bryan Band.
Oh, nice.
But what's interesting about the Jeffrey Bryan Band was, yes, it was all my own music. I had no other people to compete with respect to like Patrick and I were sort of the two driving forces of the reach. Whereas the Jeffrey Bryan Band was all about me. So, you know, it wasn't designed that way. It was just, I put it together, and the guys I was able to find were more my age and less knowledgeable than the guys previously. So it was like, Jeff, where are we playing? Where are we doing? So I ended up booking the band. I ended up writing all the songs. I did everything. I worked with, I found this guitar player. His name's Doug Rappaport. And Doug was phenomenal guitar player. And he was about 20. I was about 24, 25. He was probably a few years younger than me. And, you know, I considered him a baby. But he was this crazy, amazing guitar player. And he went on to play with, my mind's going, can't even think of his name right now. It'll come to me. Anyway, went on to play with some really famous guys for like 15 years.
Oh, wow.
And why can't I think of his name? You know him. His brother died recently. He's albino. I can't remember his name. How funny. Whatever. Anyhow, he had a song, Frankenstein. Dun, 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 dun. Why can't I think of
Alice
his name?
Oh, Alice Cooper?
No.
Oh.
But someone in that someone, it doesn't matter. It's not about me anyhow. Yeah. So, but my point is I always was able, I always had these really, you know, interesting people that either were around me or I discovered they were interesting after I wasn't around.
Yeah. Yeah.
Years later, God, it's going to bug me now. Edgar Winter. Oh, I have no idea. He's Edgar Winter's guitar player. I mean, very well known in guitar circles as, you know, a guitar god.
Oh,
and,
dude.
I was in a band with him when he was, you know, just starting out, in the Jeffrey Bryan Band. So, I mean, I had so many bands. So it was Jeffrey Bryan Band. There was Live and Die, which did. we used to play at FM Station all the time. Anyone from LA would love hearing that. I mean, FM Station.
Yeah, that was like a big bar or club.
Well, Filthy McNasty owned it. So that's all you need to know, right? The guy's name was Filthy McNasty.
Jesus.
He's famous. He owned a whole bunch of different properties in LA in the heyday, in the 70s for him. But FM station was kind of a rocking place, and it was on Lancashire and in the Valley. And it was a famous, this is famous as the Roxy at one point.
Yeah.
And, yeah, we used to play there like all the time. Coconut Teaser on Sunset was another one. So I played, but a band that I was in for quite a long time had the, in my opinion, the shittiest name of all, Sun Lions, believe it or not. Sounds like a football team.
Yeah.
I have no idea how we ended up on that name, but that band was really good. We put out two records, and, we came real close to getting some major things. Had a lot of college radio play. This was in the 90s, so there still was no internet. You know, it wasn't there was nowhere to, you had to literally do a show and sell records and physical records. You know, I mean, it's such a weird world right now compared to what I came from.
Oh, I know.
But so I had many, many bands, and I continued to play in all these bands. And all the while I was developing my chops, you know, playing keys and guitar. But keyboards has always been extremely important to my development. And, you know, it's sort of my love. It's kind of where, you know, I can sit down at a piano and just get lost for 2 hours.
That's awesome.
So that's so that brings us to you so asked me.
Yeah. No, sorry. So what I was going to say is, so how'd that come about? So that was 2017, you auditioned for Survivor?
Yeah, well, it was, I mean, basically, I've got all these cool stories. I could tell you, you know, shit more cool stories, shitloads of them, but this is not a cool story. The Survivor thing is just, I have no idea. I got an email. That's about as cool as it gets. I got an email. It said, do you want to play for Survivor? And I looked at the email one day, and I said to my wife, someone lied. Was this a joke? You know, because who just writes, do you want to play keyboards for Survivor? But then I looked at the email address, and it was from Irving Azoff's office.
Oh, wow.
You know, and so I was like, it's got to be something to this. And I looked them up. They had a keyboard player. I actually know them. I knew the guy, you know, he's a local keyboard player in LA. And, so I was like, what's going on here? So I answered back finally. And, it turned out that they were looking for another keyboard player, and we just went on from there. They flew me out to Chicago and we played, and actually, you know, part of what they wanted, Frankie Sullivan, who, you know, wrote Eye of the Tiger, wrote all that great stuff with Jim Peterik. He wanted to, at that time, make sure that who he was bringing in was a writer and not just a player. So I think that was attractive to them. And all my years of, you know, obviously writing music, I was perfect for that. You know, it was a good fit in that respect. Yeah. But I till this day, I never asked them how they got my name because I thought it didn't look good. So I said, screw it. But I often think about it. I'm playing in LA so often and everywhere else. I play all over the country with different bands that I'm in now. They're not necessarily, you know, huge names or famous, but they work a lot, and yeah. I work a lot. So, or was before all this, you know, and it's very possible that they came across me through people I knew or have known or what, you know. But unfortunately, I don't really have a great story.
The no, real you know story what? in 20, 30 years, that could be a rad story when emails like to the wayside, and they're like, yeah. "Dude, you got an email?"
Right, right. Instead of, you know, instead of just getting it from the cloud directly into my brain.
Yes. Yeah. So is there one thing that was pretty cool you mentioned before, and I wanted to tie it in, but you said like you didn't know until later in life, like what you liked about going on the stage. Do you still to this day get like, I'm guessing you mean like the rush from it being on stage in front of people?
Yeah. There's nervous energy, and that nervous energy can be utilized negatively or positively.
Oh yeah.
Depending on how you direct it. And so and I'm not the only one that has said this, but I think it's pretty appropriate, is that if you're not nervous when you get on stage, you probably shouldn't be getting on stage.
Oh, totally, man.
You know, there's a certain anxiety that you have to deal with, which isn't a bad thing if you know how to harness it, because it's that energy that puts you on a pin, you know, head of a pin, that it makes you very sharp. And I guess I'm a little bit of an adrenaline junkie for performing. I'm not a bungee jumper.
Good.
You know, I'm not going to do handstands on a chopper. You know, that's just not me. But getting on stage is my bungee jump, I guess, for me. You know, it's what I need to do. And, you know, during this lockdown period, it's the first time in my life that a weekend had gone by that I didn't get on a stage.
Yeah, that's true. That's wild.
I mean, I never thought about it in those terms, but my life is living from stage to stage, from show to show, you know, come home, work on some music, rehearse, travel to a show. That's all I do. That's what I've been doing for 20 years.
Yeah.
I can't do it right now. And I'm freaking out. I mean, I don't know what to do with myself. You know, it's hard.
Are you writing a lot? Were you able to, obviously we're 3 months in now. Are you finally able to get into a routine being home, or is it still weird?
Not what I want. You know, obviously, I mean, every day I keep thinking it's, you know, I'm going to wake up from this nightmare, but I mean, it's not like, I mean, there are people that have it far worse. We're not sick, fortunately. And you know, we're not on the streets. So, I mean, I have to be careful. It's a very serious problem that we have right now. And I'm fortunate that at least I have my studio and I can still create. Yeah. So I'm doing the best to make lemonade out of lemons.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people are. I think we're going to see a lot of really good stuff from talented people come out of this period. Who knows what we'll see, or how, but, I play a lot, you know. I'm recording little videos I put up on my Facebook page, and
oh sweet, I
try to make it like a performance, you know. And then I still have other projects and bands that I'm working with. We're actually starting to prepare to go back out.
Oh yeah.
What's interesting about this COVID situation is that big national acts that are usually being booked in conjunction with like Live Nation,
and
some of these big concert promoters, those concerts aren't coming back. Like Survivor right now, we're done for the year.
Yeah,
you know, we had a whole year booked. In fact, I was about to board a plane before I got a call in March that said we're not doing this gig. I didn't know I was going to stay home. I just knew we were canceling the gig.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I turned around, came home, and didn't go back out for 3 months. And then, you know, talking to them, they basically, they're shut down. And a lot of the bigger acts are shut down. But some of the smaller acts, the ones that play casinos and some of the mid-size rooms and some of the outdoor shows, they're going to come back a lot quicker. Just because it's, you know, it's probably less dangerous in their calculation. Yeah. So I'm preparing to go out with a couple bands that I play with now that I'm looking forward to.
That'll
so that's
cool.
Good. Yeah.
What's your, great. You've played everywhere. I'm sure. Is there like a favorite venue or a city that you've played in?
I'm really partial to LA.
Yeah, well, yeah, I'm sure.
It's my hometown, and I grew up, you know, at a time when a lot of really iconic places I got to be in. I got to play at Gazzari's, the Troubadour, you know, Club Lingerie, the Viper Room, which was used to be called the El Centro.
Oh, wow.
And so, I mean, those were my homes, you know. And so I don't want to see them closing. I don't want to see them. And I know the Troubadour's having trouble.
Yeah, there's
a lot of real famous iconic places that are in danger. I think personally, to answer your question though, for me, I like the more intimate places. I mean, I've played, you know, in front of 30,000 people, and you don't, it's not the same. It's more exciting to play for 500 people.
Yeah.
Or 1,000 people. It really is. Then, I mean, yeah, it's exciting when you're walking on stage and you see, you know, a throng of people, but that goes away real fast when you start to play, because you really can't see beyond maybe 15, 20 rows. True, yeah. Beyond that, it just looks like water, a sea of heads, you know? So you don't really connect with the way you connect with that kind of an audience is different. You know, it's a more, it's an almost internal thing, and you kind of project it everywhere. Whereas in an intimate, more intimate setting, you can see smiles, you can see people singing, you can kind of, and that interaction is what I think most musicians crave anyway. So, yeah, one of my, you know, I love the Roxy. There's a few small places that we played in Chicago that are really, really nice that we played. You probably wouldn't, they're not famous places, but just the smaller venue rooms that we did.
That's cool.
Yeah. So
that's awesome. Do you remember the first time that you played like in front of a lot of people, like you coming out in the crowd, just all those people?
Yeah. But I was so young. My first time on stage was probably in front of 5,000 people.
Oh my God.
So playing the Hungry Tiger to five was odd, you know. You know, obviously it became normal because, you know, I sang in front of a congregation. I was singing at my bar mitzvah. Okay. I wasn't a singer at the time, but the cantor, his name is Nate Lamb. And he's an interesting guy. You should look him up. L-A-M, Lamb. Cantor Nate Lamb was known as, and I didn't know this growing up. I knew this growing up, but I didn't know it at the time, is what I meant. He was considered to be the singing teacher to the stars.
Oh my God.
He had a side hustle at the temple teaching major actors like John Travolta and people like that how to sing.
Oh my God.
I mean, it was Stephen S. Weiss. So it was kind of had a very affluent congregation, and a lot of Hollywood people went to this particular temple. So I sang, I was 13. It was time to kind of learn how to sing these Torah scriptures. I'm not a religious person. I none of that was interesting to me, but the music part of it was.
Yeah.
And so, so I got to sing. So I said, all right, whatever. So I learned this part and I got up. And during these kind of events, like a high holidays ceremony, you know, it's a religious ceremony. It's not, you know, stand up and clap and do a standing ovation. Yeah. And I got one. And I guess the reason why is that I'm a pretty in stature. I'm not real tall, you know? So, and at 13, I was probably, you know, the size of like, you know, I was 6 inches. I was a really small kid, but I had a voice that could project all the way to the back of the room. And I think that just floored people, and I could sing in tune too. So it was even more powerful. So I've always been able to harness that energy. And so my first experiences were always in front of a lot of people. So I don't know if you're asking me if it made me nervous to be in front of a lot of people. No, being on stage does not make me nervous.
No, it seems like you loved it, like right from the beginning, like you like thrived from it.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. Now I will tell you that getting on stage is harder than being on stage, if you know what I mean.
Oh, it's
especially I'm not ashamed to admit it, especially with Survivor. There's a certain, when you're doing your own music, you know, you have a loyalty to yourself and to the fans if they know the music. But when you're dealing with a legacy such as Survivor, 35 year legacy that I feel like a steward of their material. I didn't write it. I'm not there. The people aren't there for Jeff, as much as I'd like to believe they are. They are not. They're there to hear Eye of the Tiger. They're here, you know, High on You. They want to hear those songs. And so there's a little bit of, you know, am I going to let them down? You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so that little bit of nervousness can be uncomfortable. But once I'm on stage and I sit down, and what makes me at ease is touching this.
Yeah.
As soon as I touch this, it's like some kind of magical force, and I'm like, I'm good.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, man, dude. This has been so awesome, man.
I'm having fun. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking time. One thing I like to ask people before I let them go is, obviously, you were doing music for a long, long time.
Yeah.
Was there anything else that you thought you could have done, like before music, or was there any other passions that you had?
Yeah, you got to remember, I discovered music at about 12 years old.
I know, yeah.
And I didn't decide to be a singer or a musician until a whole 2 years later. So,
yeah.
I was pretty young the whole time. So, but before that, I still have an interest in science. I was always very science minded. I wasn't very good at math, but I liked to theorize and conceptualize. I was always interested in, I always thought I was probably going to end up some kind of theoretical science of some kind. I used to read a lot about, you know, quantum mechanics and stuff like that. So I was always interested in that. I don't know if that would have become a passion for me or not. Astronomy was a big hobby of mine when I was really young. I had a telescope and I couldn't wait to just, you know, see what I could see and discover. So I've always been very, and I've always been really electronically inclined too. I like to tinker with stuff and, you know, like my Rhodes and my Wurlitzer, I like to mess around with it. And so I think I probably would have been somewhere in the science end of things.
That's awesome. I always love asking people that, like, no matter what they do, act, direct, you know, behind the scenes, musician. And it's always cool to hear, especially when they found something so young. Sometimes it's like, I wanted to be a doctor, and they were like 10 years old. But then after that, dude, they just started acting. So yeah. Like, that goes out the window. But dude, thank you so much for taking the time. I'm so happy.
Thank you for having me.
Shout out to me. But dude, your stories and just everything about you is so cool, man.
Thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate it. I've done a few podcasts that are just audio, but I like seeing who I'm talking to. It's kind of
cool. Know what? I always did audio because when I started this, I never thought somebody would talk to me. So like in the beginning, I sent out a bunch of emails to like agents and stuff. And there was like a few people that bit. And then the first one I did, we did video, but it wasn't like I said, like, hey, we're doing video. But now flash forward like a year later, I've seen that people enjoy video a lot more. So I'm doing video now.
I would think that, you know, with what it looks like a lot of your guests are actors and actresses.
Yeah.
They probably prefer this venue. You know,
they do. No, I mean, but I never was going to do video.
Just knowing how vain they are. I know I am. So, you know,
no, but just doing the video is like in my head, I'm like, all right, so I got to put it on podcast. Then I got to like edit a video and put that on YouTube, cut that. So I'm like, man, I got a daughter. I'm in school. I work full time. And I'm like, but now I'm like, it's totally worth it.
Yeah.
And it's cool. You're right. The connection with people, like talking to people is awesome, man.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you being interested.
Thanks for telling me your story. It was cool. And next time Survivor, I feel like Survivor was going to come to Jersey this year, if I'm right, right?
We were supposed to Connecticut. I don't recall a Jersey.
Connecticut. You guys are going to be, because I'm in tri-state area, so we always get like whatever comes up. So probably the casino out there, no?
Yeah, Foxwoods. Foxwoods, yeah.
Yeah.
That's Connecticut, right?
Yeah, it's not too far from me.
Or I don't know if it's Connecticut, but it's somewhere in that neighborhood, yeah.
Yeah.
We were in Seneca Falls not too long ago.
Oh, okay, New York.
Which is still far from Jersey, but, you know.
Yeah, not too far. That's out by, like, the Baseball Hall of Fame, like, out that way. Like, Cooperstown.
Not far from Niagara Falls, I think.
Oh, that's – I got married there, yeah.
Yeah.
Cool, man. Well, Jeffrey, thank you. Enjoy the rest of the night. Hopefully,
my pleasure, Doug.
I don't know when this is going to be over, but hopefully you can get back on stage and get that rush.
Oh, my God, yes. Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
I'll reach out. I'll probably put this out in the next few weeks, and I'll definitely let you know beforehand and send you everything. Okay.
All right. Thanks, Doug. Have a great night. Thank you.
Peace out, man.
All right.
Bye. Man, wasn't Jeffrey awesome? He was so cool. It's like a guy I can talk to for hours, especially just he does like that grueling job. You know, he's going from city to city. He's just rocking out. For him right now, he even said this is like something he's never done before. He's never not worked. So make sure I'm going to put his website in the episode notes, or if you're watching this, you know, in the YouTube notes, and you'll be able to check out his website, see all the stuff that he's worked on. But dude, the behind the scenes on Karate Kid, you can't get that anywhere else. Well, I guess maybe if you're at a Ralph Macchio like dinner party or Martin Cove, maybe, but not as cool as this, because this isn't a main character. He's really, when I talk to people that are smaller parts in some of these big movies, maybe later on they go on to do bigger things, their eyes are more wide open because they see it all. So yeah, so make sure you check out him out, and don't forget to review, rate, share our podcast, follow us on all social media at Sequels Only, and don't forget to check out our website, sequelsonly.com. Good night.